Good evening and welcome to Open Air with Sherry Huber on World Talk Radio. I'm your host, Michael Gray, and we'll be talking about conscious, compassionate awareness in today's show. And today's show is a special pre-recorded show. So don't call us today, but call us back when we're live on the air again. So we look forward to taking your calls then. Good evening and welcome to Open Air with Sherry Huber on World Talk Radio. Good evening, Sherry.
Good evening, Michael.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Great.
And yourself?
Well, I have to tell you, I was just thinking about it. For me, it's a very busy time at work.
Uh-huh.
And on Friday and today, it was both days were very busy, just one thing after another.
Uh-huh.
And Friday, I was miserable. I was hating life. There's something wrong with me, something wrong with everybody else. And today was a totally different experience. You know? You got to wonder.
Uh-huh.
You got to wonder.
Nothing had changed, though?
What's that?
Had anything changed besides you?
Yeah. I remembered that I do a spiritual practice.
Uh-huh.
You remembered to be aware?
Yes.
The breath?
Yes, and I found a little humor.
Not take it so seriously and personally.
Yes. Yes.
Amazing,
what a blessing.
Yeah.
Because I can see, I project onto other people that it's a misery.
Uh-huh.
And that's just how it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I project that onto people a lot, too. people generally speaking,
yes,
kind of seem to equate busy with stress and misery.
Yes. And it can be invigorating and fun and fast-paced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And if it's invigorating, fun, and fast-paced, then we don't have to be so heavily rewarded by constant trips to the shopping mall.
Yes.
We don't have to idealize another life experience, you know, the weekend or vacation or whatever
yes.
it is.
Yes.
Yeah, it's quite a nasty little setup, a nasty little bind that conditioning gets people in. Because
yes.
here's life, here's my life, this is my life, and I don't like it.
I hate it.
I hate it, and I'm constantly looking for a way around it, a way out of it.
Yeah,
and it's that little tiny shift that says, wait a minute, this is my life.
Yes.
You know, what if, for most of the people we know, the lives they're living are lives of choice.
Yes.
You know, people go to school, they get a whole lot of education so that they can get the job that they want, and then they hate the job.
Yes.
It's so interesting.
Yes.
And also the habit of, or the belief, or whatever it is, that, and so I'm stuck here. I'm trapped. I can't make another choice.
Yes.
And that's just so often not the case.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, it feels like it. I understand that it feels very real and true, but that's not the same as it's real and true.
Yes. Yes. And I think about, too, the privilege of my life compared to most of the people on this planet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I should know, what the percentage is of people who are going to bed every night hungry, the percentage of people who are living under $2 a day, living
yes.
on less than $1 a day.
Yes.
I don't know those statistics. It would be good in my line of work, but I don't.
Yes.
And here we are, living in this world of tremendous privilege and
yes.
And still managing to let conditioned mind ruin it all for us.
Yes, yes. And in that sense, as I've heard you talk about, I can't receive it.
Uh-huh.
I can't receive all of the blessings that have appeared to me in this life.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So for the person in that position, there aren't blessings.
Yes.
Yeah, because it doesn't feel like it, doesn't seem like it. I can't see it. I don't get it. How is this blessed?
Yes.
I have to go to this job that I hate every day, and live in this place. I don't want to live with these people. I don't want to live in you know, I'm stuck in traffic. And how? Where are the blessings?
Yes.
Yeah, that's you know, that's one of the reasons that I'm so eager with this work that we do in Africa, to be able to take people with us.
Yes.
To these places where people are living with nothing.
Yes.
And still managing to appreciate life and enjoy it.
Yes.
And of course, I think a huge part of that is they don't have an expectation that it's ever going to be any different, or that it should be any different.
Yes.
It's always been like this. We have no reason to think it's going to be any other than this. So, well, this is what we've got. We might as well have the best time we can have.
Yes.
And it's quite, for me anyway, I don't know what it would be like for other people, but for me it's just such a good reminder of all of the opportunities that I have, and that I want to avail myself of those opportunities. I don't want to wait. And
yes,
the things that are important to me, I want to prioritize those and put my attention to it. And no, I'm not going to wait till I retire.
Yeah.
Thanks awfully.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Sherry, I have a stack of email questions here.
And an opportunity to get through them.
An opportunity to get through them.
Before they start disintegrating there, and you're, you may keep them on the computer. They'll stay fresh a lot longer. But for the person who wrote them.
Yes, and who's been listening and waiting.
Might not feel fresh.
Yes.
Yeah, so this is a good thing.
Yeah, so I have 7 questions here, and we'll get as far as we get.
All right.
Gasho, Sherry, and Michael. Sherry, here's a question that has been bugging me for several days now. In Zen, as you say, there are no beliefs. Believe nothing. In Christianity, there is a belief that people are basically sinful because of the whole Adam and Eve thing known as the fall, and that they can be saved by confessing their mistakes, asking forgiveness, and accepting Jesus as Lord and Savior. Many Christians believe this firmly. It occurred to me that the essence of this process is similar to what you teach and what we practice. If we look at conditioning and self-hate as the fall from grace, grace meaning center, and confession as seeing our projections and unhealthy patterns, and we see accepting Jesus as Savior as realizing that we are loved and accepted exactly as we are.
Which, let us point out for the record, is what Jesus taught.
Yes. I'd love to hear your comments on this observation. Also, there are a lot of beliefs involved here. What do we call the teaching that our essential nature is goodness? Isn't that a belief? What does it mean to believe nothing? Gasho from a listener in Pennsylvania.
Well, we have to take this in stages, right?
Yes.
You'll have to remind me of those second two because...
Yes, sure.
It's a long ways from question number one to question number two and three.
Yeah.
So I was actually just listening to a program the other night on religion. Happened to be on NPR.
Uh-huh.
And there were two, I think the fellow's name is Sam Harris, but I'm not certain of this. He wrote a book, I think it was called The End of Religion. See, I'm about as firm on these facts as on the number of people living in poverty in places like Africa that I'm passionately interested in. So we can say statistics are not my long suit. But I think something like that. Harris, I'm pretty sure, and I think it's called The End of Religion. He's very adamant about the destructive nature of religion, and we need to get over it and stop it and grow up and pay attention and see how things really work and before we kill each other. And then the next person who was interviewed was, I think her name is pronounced Karen Armstrong, but I'm not certain. She's the former nun who's become, I guess, you know, kind of the world's foremost expert on religion, just on, you know, the different types and their history and what they're doing now and this sort of thing. Okay. And she called that perspective chauvinistic. And the idea that our understanding of the way life works is reality. So somebody's looking at the world today through the eyes of conditioning, that an average, if you could say that, citizen of the U.S. has, growing up in a Judeo-Christian culture and then seeing what's happened as a result of that from their perspective and blah, 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 blah. And she did a pretty good job, I thought, of sort of taking the whole thing apart. And
yes.
What her latest book is something about transformation, and she's talking about the fact that all of, or many of the major religions had their beginnings at about the same time, Hinduism and Confucianism and Buddhism and, you know, these folks. And I don't know what Judaism actually was doing at that time. But it was, you know, approximately 500 years before the birth of Jesus.
Yeah.
And that all of them were essentially saying the same thing. And that what they're saying is what is familiar to people who know our practice.
Yeah.
You know, we have the ability to leave center, to believe that we are separate from the world and from life. As that a belief in separation grows, we become identified as a separate ego. Then the survival of the ego becomes the most essential thing. And from that, of course, we're willing to rape, pillage, plunder, maim, kill, whatever is necessary to keep our ego at the center of the universe. And what all these religions have in common is the fact that they see that illusion of being separate from life as the cause of suffering.
Yeah.
And the interviewer said, well, you know, that's really interesting, but in essence, you know, there are a lot of people who would say Buddhism, for instance, is not a religion. It's just a you know, sort of a way of looking at life. She said, there we go with that chauvinism again, you know, because you think religion looks like this.
Yeah.
When somebody else's religion doesn't look like that, the knee-jerk is to say that it's not a religion. So the point of all of this for me is that most people who have looked at how life works and how human beings are and, you know, what if we just break it down that way, what leads us towards suffering and away from suffering, they come up with pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, human beings get a hold of it. And human beings then do the thing that human beings tend to do, especially conditioned human beings, and they turn it into something that it was never intended to be. And and then we think that that's the religion. So, you know, people will regularly ask me about the Buddhist monks who poured gasoline on themselves during the Vietnam War and lit themselves on fire. And you know, how can this be this way? And, you know, what do you think of Christians who are this and this and this? And what about the way the Israelis treat the Palestinians? On and on and on. And it's like, now, wait a minute. We've got to be able to step back and sort out what is the essence of the religion or the faith and what is what essentially conditioned mind has done to distort that and use it for its own purposes. So to me, the answer is, you know, you get back to center, you get back to the heart of a thing, and you look at what is there.
Yes.
And when you do that, you can, at least in my experience, easily speak in any number of languages about that experience. You can talk about it in absolute Christian terms, in absolute Jewish terms, absolute Hindu terms, absolute Buddhist terms, and not have a single difficulty with that.
Yes. Yes. So
now,
tell me if I'm hearing you correctly, that essentially all religions have a similar message.
Yes, at the core.
Yes.
And it's important to me, as somebody with a great deal of respect for Jesus, to remember that there's a big difference between what Jesus was saying, what Jesus was talking about, and how his life and message have been interpreted through time. For instance, the simple, obvious fact that Jesus was not a Christian. He was
yes.
a Jew.
Yes.
So, you know, we forget these simple, obvious facts as we get caught up in our beliefs about what something is and what it means.
Right, right.
What was the second part of that, Michael? The
second part of that is, also, there are a lot of beliefs involved here. What do we call the teaching that our essential nature is goodness? Isn't that a belief? What does it mean to believe nothing?
It would be a belief for the person who hadn't had the experience.
Uh-huh.
Once you have the experience, you don't have to believe it. There's no sense in believing it. You'd be foolish to believe it. Why believe it if it is your experience?
Yes.
So that's the advantage of experience over beliefs. With experience, you don't have a bunch of stuff you have to drag around into each moment to refer to tell you what life is like. You can just simply be present in the moment that you're in, and that's what life is like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Fascinating.
And there was a third part.
That's, what does it mean to believe nothing?
Oh,
what are you referring to?
Well, of course, it doesn't mean anything.
Let me guess.
That one was easy.
Nothing means anything.
Yeah. And once again, if you have that experience, that answers all the questions. Takes us out of the conditioned mind right into the moment. What is it like? What does it mean? Is just a, you know, unfortunate approach to the thing. But what is it like? What is it like to believe nothing?
Yes.
Well, have an experience of believing nothing, and then you know the answer to that question.
Yes.
The old one that I always go to is, what does an avocado taste like?
Yes.
Well, how long would we have to talk and just thoroughly miss the point before somebody said, let me run to the store.
Where's the guacamole?
Yeah, we can put this to rest in just a moment here. Let's open this little beauty up, and there.
Yes.
That's what it tastes like.
Great. Okay, ready for the next question?
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Sherry. I have felt since I was very small that I had a gift for writing. I write fiction novels and try to manifest success in the commercial aspects of writing, namely getting published and making a living with what I love. I have felt that I'm, quote, meant, unquote, to do this. I'm very happy in my current life by meditating and enjoying as much as possible, but there is still this grain in me that says, but someday it is going to happen. I am confused about these, quote, gifts, unquote. I and others feel that they have been given. Is it ego telling us this? Is it ego that says we have these gifts? Is it ego that says find a way? If it isn't helpful to, quote, be, unquote, this, or, quote, be, unquote, that, then are the things we perceive as gifts of any purpose at all? Is it better to just give it up and allow myself to continue in jobs that just pay the rent because I can be happy doing this and am by being very careful of my thoughts and my state of consciousness while doing so? Is it unhelpful to have dreams? I am reminded of this quote.
Wait. We have to break this down.
Would you like to start there?
You know, this is kind of like the previous question.
Yeah.
What we do is leave center, and then from a conditioned reality, we want to figure out life.
Yeah.
We want to know what's so and what isn't and what's right and what's wrong and what does this mean and how does this work. And it just, it's never, ever going to happen, which is why people are so endlessly frustrated. You know, the whole idea of manifesting is just, it's just unfortunate as far as I'm concerned.
Uh-huh.
Because we live in a dualistic world. We always get both sides of the coin. So here I am. The favorite is manifesting abundance. Okay, so I'm going to affirm abundance. Well, gosh, you know, most people already have abundance that they're not appreciating. Okay, so what that means is I want more. And in my experience, that I want more is what keeps it from happening.
Wow.
I want more is the most effective way to close the door to more that exists.
Wow.
The thing that opens the door to more, in my experience, is gratitude for what is.
Wow.
And I don't mean I'm going to be grateful for what I've got so that I'll get more. Work that way. That's like trying to let go of something so that I'll get rid of it. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
The way it does work is to be so focused on all of the things that life has provided that there is no more desire for anything more. And at the same moment that that desire falls away, there is an experience of such abundance that it is impossible to take it all in.
Wow.
So it's that, again, being up in conditioned mind, looking at life, okay, I have this, this isn't enough, I want that, this is what's important to me, I think I should have this, I have a karma for this, or this is a gift that I have, and it needs to take this form, it needs to look this way. You see, all of that time spent in conditioned mind trying to figure out life is what keeps us from having life. So if I like to write, you know, and I feel like I have an ability, if I've gotten feedback that I have an ability along these lines, then how about life being in charge of how that ability is used?
Yes.
If there's a gift, how about letting life be in charge of how that gift is opened and received and given back?
Yes. Yes. Turning our lives over to life.
Yeah. Because that's what's living life. And the fact that we get to be here enjoying that and appreciating it, participating in it, is not the same as we have control over it or we have the ability to make this or that or something else happen. Now, we do actually have that ability, but what I'm trying to point out is that when the person is attempting to affirm more, what they are affirming is less.
Uh-huh.
So by saying, I want abundance, I am affirming abundance, what I'm really affirming is my lack. If I weren't focused on my lack, I wouldn't think I wanted more. So we are essentially creating the reality that we live in. It's just that we have to learn sort of the rules of how the whole thing operates.
Yeah.
And focusing on lack is never going to lead to more. Except
yeah.
more lack. See?
Which
and then what happens, as the writer, I think, is describing, is that life gets more and more frustrating.
Yes.
More challenging. You know, then pretty soon there's more time spent up in the head. Well, but I don't understand, because what about this? And I'm doing this, and I feel like this, and I see this, and how come that's not? And what we need to do, once again, is just drop it. Take a deep breath. Sit down in a quiet place. And say, okay, I'm going to let life call the shots.
Mm-hmm.
What's next? What do I do?
Yeah.
And once again, in my experience, the information just starts flooding in. Now, will conditioning also send information? Sure. You know, we'll send your book to so-and-so and send it off to this and talk to this person. And maybe, and you can be doing all of that, but don't forget to be open to other information that comes through as well. So if somebody comes up and says, you know, I'm working on this thing and we really need somebody to write some stuff for us. Don't say, no, I can't do that because I've got to stay focused on my novel. That could be the very doorway that life is opening for you.
Yeah.
And we have a tendency to say no because that's not my vision. That's not my dream. That's not what I want to do with my life.
Right.
But it's the thing that we can always keep in mind is if I could get myself where I want to be, I'd already be there.
If I could get myself where I want to be, I'd already
be
there.
There.
In other words, if I can get to the moment, I'll have everything that I desire.
That's right. And doing all of the things that I may have been conditioned to do all of my life to get what I want obviously doesn't work because I don't have what I want.
Yes.
So we might as well try the moment.
Try the moment.
Yeah.
Sounds like a new book title.
Yeah. That would be a good moment. title, wouldn't it? Good
when
moment.
All else fails.
Good moment for a book title. Yeah.
Great.
I'm jot that down right here. I'll credit you, of course.
Good.
Yeah. Okay.
Ready for another question?
Yeah. Was there a lot more with that one that we didn't cover with that response?
There's not a lot more. There's a little bit more, if you'd like me to read a little more.
Now we can start from here.
Let me read a little bit more. Is it unhelpful to have dreams? I am reminded of this quote from somewhere that if God gives you a garden, who are you to leave it in darkness? Throw the light on it, water it, let it grow. I think of this sometimes, how I could let my tendency towards writing become a secret inside of me, something I store away, and it makes me so sad I want to cry thinking of it. I am very confused. Any thoughts, perspectives, not advice, I know, with love.
Very, very confused.
Uh-huh.
That last part would certainly indicate that.
Yes.
That if this doesn't go the way I think it should, then that leaves me very sad.
Yes.
And I don't. Those are not the two choices. Either I do it the way conditioned mind tells me to do it, or I have to do nothing and feel very sad.
Right.
There are just, the whole world lies between those two extremes. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and it seems like you were pointing at these issues when you were talking earlier about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that we, there's the garden. So all we need to do is just water it, tend it, be there with it, and it'll produce magic things. So it's not that we're out there tugging the little plants up out of the ground or, you know, pouring so much water on them that they drown. We're just, we're tending, we're being there, we're being present.
Yes.
And letting that sort of miracle happen.
Yes. Yes. Wonderful.
And what we're also not doing is standing over on the edge going, you know, this is not what I wanted in this garden. You know, this is not it. These plants don't look right. This is, you know, I wanted all red flowers.
I want that garden over there.
Yeah, I want that person's garden.
Yes. Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next question. Gasho, Sherry, and Michael. First, I want to say thank you for doing the show. I enjoy it so much. My question relates to having fun with practice. I have been involved with this particular practice for about 4 years. For the past few months, I have found myself strongly drawn to a more playful spirit in my practice, not so much the sitting part, but through the rest of my day. Here's an example. I notice the thought that someone is conceited. In the past,
say that again, Michael.
I notice the thought that someone is conceited.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, I might, quote, own, unquote, this projection by saying to myself something like, quote, I probably have some conceitedness in me too. Yes, that's true. I can see it, unquote. Then I would feel sort of bad for that conceitedness, plus a little more bad for projecting, and that's it. Nowadays, I am finding myself able to enjoy a situation like that. When I notice I'm projecting conceitedness, then I try letting my conceited aspect out to play. She wants to jump around like Muhammad Ali saying, quote, I am the greatest, unquote. It feels great to let this side of me out. I'm not identified with her, and I'm able to enjoy her energy and humor. She is fun. Some inner voices are saying that it is just not okay and not really practice. But it feels like practice. It feels good in my heart and makes me feel deeply accepted and okay. Someone is saying that it is okay to hug your subpersonalities or reassure them, but not let them do things like jump around, sing, play loud music, enjoy superficial things like wearing makeup, laughing at stupid humor, etc. They think that Zen practice is all about silence and restraint. As I write that, I see that much of my conditioning is about being silent and restrained as well. Sherry, I would really appreciate your input on this.
Well, I don't need to have any input.
Yeah.
Now, the writing makeup, I'm going to project that that's this is a female writing, so, but, you know, not necessarily. But, you know, she got there herself.
Yeah, absolutely.
The conditioning is trying to make practice into something miserable and awful and humorless so that, you know, we'll all quit. But
yes.
Conditioning is miserable and humorless. You know, she's never heard anything in this practice to encourage her toward that conditioned perspective and away from enjoying whatever's there. Now, of course, what I would encourage people to do is be present. So, you know, if you're, this is extreme, but people, I think, will follow my drift here. You know, you're at a funeral, and some part of you wants to come out and make jokes. Well, you probably wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
In center, you would probably say to that person, hey, you know, this might not be the best time for that. Let's wait till a little later to have that conversation. Or might have a conversation right there that says, yeah, you know, it's great that you enjoy life and you see humor and everything, but, you know, it would probably be hurtful to people if you were to do that now. So, you know, there's nothing about being centered that means we have to squelch ourselves, but it also is not license.
Yeah.
Center never is interested in doing anything that is inappropriate.
Yeah.
It might actually do things, you know, if you read old Zen stuff, you know that Zen has a history of people doing outrageous stuff, just outrageous stuff. But it's not hurtful, and it's not harmful. It shakes people's conditioned way of thinking, but it's not. There's nothing unconscious about it, and it's when we're unconscious and identified that we do the kind of inappropriate things that wind up being hurtful and harmful.
Yes.
So, yeah, you know,
yeah.
Muhammad Ali's personality jumps out and acts out. That's great, as long as it's in a way and a place that is appropriate.
Yes. Yeah. Great.
Yeah. Does that sound...
Sounds spot on to me.
That's clear, isn't it?
That's clear.
You know, conditioning always wants to use something like that and say, oh, well, yeah, but it's never appropriate to. Well, yes, of course it is. I mean, if people spend time around us, I mean, how could people listen to me and think that I'm grim about life? My God. During that question, I was thinking about the depression book. You know, my encouragement to people to have depression parties and talking about how I would go out and rent 4 videos and cook and run around and turn on music and dance and all of these kinds of things as a way of being present with and moving the energy of depression. So, no.
Yes.
Not a conflict.
Yes, yes. Wonderful. Thank you for that, Sherry. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber on World Talk Radio. We're going to break now, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes. Second segment of today's show, we'll be continuing our conversation on conscious compassionate awareness. Today's show is a special pre-recorded show in response to email questions, and please call in next time when we're on the air live, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes. Welcome back. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber on World Talk Radio. Sherry, I had a quick question.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you'd be willing to talk a little about how this show is supported.
Yes.
How it happens that we're here every week.
Yeah.
And everybody can listen.
And there's a lot involved in that, isn't there?
There's a lot involved.
Yeah. And so, of course, the way it happens is that we pick up the tab for being here and making this conversation available to people.
Yeah.
And it's the same way that we do pretty much everything we do. So the monastery is there, and, you know, we as a group pick up the tab for that. So people make donations, they contribute, the money goes into a great big pot, and we come up with all of the ways that we can possibly think of to put this practice out and make it available to as many people as we possibly can. And of course, the radio show is particularly designed to support people who live far away from us.
Yeah.
People who live close in California or you know, just a little beyond, can come to the monastery often. They can come to the Zen Center in Palo Alto and have a lot of opportunity for workshops and retreats and that sort of thing that support their practice. But people who live on the other side of the country, you know, maybe we're there once a year or twice a year somewhere nearby, and that feels kind of few and far between. So the radio show is our attempt to have a group discussion available for people every week. So at the monastery and at the Zen Center in Palo Alto and at sitting groups around the country, people get together once a week and meditate together and then have a discussion about practice and how it goes and what's difficult and what works and that sort of thing. And this is our opportunity to do that as a whole sangha actually around the world. And so we pay for it.
Yeah.
And of course, we would be just delighted if people who enjoy the show and benefit from it would like to send along some financial support.
Yes, yes, yes. And they can do that by going to the Living Compassion website, which is livingcompassion.org.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it says donate somewhere easily accessible and support the radio show that way.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a glorious thing.
It is a glorious thing. And it's fun for me to hear, and I've heard, you know, we talk at various intervals on retreats and workshops about how to support ourselves in practice.
Yeah.
And one phrase that really sticks in my mind is supporting that which supports me.
Yeah.
And looking inward and seeing what's possible. You know, this is really important to me.
Uh-huh.
I feel like practice has saved my life.
Uh-huh.
You know, what is that worth to me?
Right.
And what is it worth to have that ongoing practice support available to me?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a way to make the practice one's own.
Yes.
You know, instead of something that other people do and I just kind of slide by once in a while and I'll listen in on the radio show or maybe I get an email and read it. But, you know, it's not, it's their thing. It's not really mine. But when we start committing ourselves in terms of time, energy, and resources, then it becomes much more immediate for us, much more, well, I hate to use the word personal, but it is in that sense. You know, it becomes my practice and the thing that I'm involved with, the thing that I do.
Yes.
And so it's very good on all levels to, as you say, to support what supports us.
Yeah. And the word that comes to mind as you talk is commitment.
Mm-hmm.
Making a commitment to myself, making a commitment to this practice.
Yeah. And that, of course, that's one of the things that conditioning fights hardest against.
Yes.
You know, it likes for a person to remain a dilettante. You know, just a dabbler. Well, I'll look into this and look into that, and conditioning can always find something wrong with this and a reason to move on to that next thing and to make sure the person never really stops long enough to commit to anything that's going to actually make a difference.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's only the things that we're committed to that make a difference in us.
I was just going to go there myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's that commitment, in my experience, that leads to the transformation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it's what helps us to stick when conditioning is doing everything it can to get us to once again bail out on ourselves and go off and do something else and feel bad, feel like a failure.
Yes. Great. Thank you for that, Sherry.
Yeah, so anybody who wants to send something along, we'll be happy.
We'll be very grateful for it.
Yeah.
Sherry, I have a couple more email questions here, and we have about 15 minutes left. So we'll see where we
get them in, huh?
Yes. I've been wanting to volunteer abroad, and I have trouble with this as I am a person who wants to try everything. Something else always stops me or I'm indecisive about it. I realize I am constantly in a state of urgency, guilt, worrying, escapism, or indecisiveness. You see, I'm trying to work on myself first. You see, there it is. I can work on myself and do these things. I really want to do this, the same as I want to spend time at the monastery to get guidance on the path to the self. What are your thoughts on this from a listener in England?
In England?
In England.
Well, that is a little bit of a schlep, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit of a trip.
Although it's not too bad. You and I have both made it, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, nonstop.
Yeah. Well, you know, what the writer is pointing at is just kind of the whole deal. We have to, if we're ever going to have the lives we want, we have to take the decision-making out of the mind of conditioning.
Yes.
And again, we're back to the commitment. You know, it really doesn't matter what a person practices with. It can be something like, well, you know, a simple, typical one in our world is meditating.
Yes.
You know, making a commitment to meditate and sticking with it.
Yes.
It's just the hardest thing in the world.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter whether it's quitting smoking, meditating, keeping the car clean, making sure the dishes are done, not yelling at the kids, not buying something just because it happens to be there in front. You know, whatever is that kind of place where we go unconscious and let conditioning act out through us. We've got to stop at one of those and say, I'm going to turn this around. I'm going to make a commitment to turning this around, and I'm going to see how I do that, because it's a process. So the person who does one really difficult thing knows that they can do all difficult things.
Yes.
And what they don't know, of course, is if you do one really simple, kind of easy thing, it also proves to you that you can do anything, because it happens the same way. And it's the steps are simple. It occurs to me what it is that I want to do, and I move forward doing that, and I don't believe and listen to and follow the voices that tell me I can't, I shouldn't, I better not, something awful is going to happen. I just keep putting one foot in front of the other and doing whatever it is until it's done. And then I put a little check mark next to that, and I look at the next thing that I'm going to practice with.
Yeah.
Not the next thing that I'm going to do or accomplish or be good at or get rich and famous over. It's not that. I am changing the relationship that I've had with conditioned mind. I'm going to stop allowing it to have control over my life, and I'm going to take that control for myself.
Yes.
So I can't remember, Michael, if we talked about this on the radio. Did I go through a little thing about finding the difference between happiness and pleasure?
No.
No?
No, you have not.
I must have been doing that at the monastery then. I was in a conversation with somebody recently, and we were talking about things like intention and purpose. You know, a lot of people are very involved in this idea of what is the purpose of my life, which, of course, you know, I don't think there is one, other than being alive.
Yes.
But, you know, living with intention and that sort of thing. And so we were talking about what, like from a spiritual perspective or from a Buddhist perspective or that sort of thing, what does it mean to live from intention? And for me, what it means is realizing that what I want to do is end suffering. And the person said, well, is that the same as you want to be happy? And I said, yes, if you don't confuse that with pleasure.
I see.
Because following pleasure around through life is the fastest way to be unhappy.
Yes.
But living from the deepest desire of one's heart produces the side effect or byproduct of happiness.
Yes.
So if what I want to do, say something that we look at a lot in our practice, you know, I want to end self-hatred. That's what I want to do. I want to end self-hatred. And so I set a course. And I just practice, and I learn how to greater and greater degrees to make choices that lead me away from suffering, away from self-hatred.
Okay? Yeah.
Moment by moment, throughout my day. And so here I am at this point in my life, and there's on the opposite wall, it says, no more self-hatred. I'm walking toward that, and every step that I take is taking me closer. So then here I am in a place where, you know, I could, let's see, what could I do that's just, you know, let's make it ridiculous. I have an opportunity to get away with embezzling $50,000 from my company.
Yes.
Okay? Well, I look at no more self-hatred on the opposite wall. Now, in the short term, that $50,000 looks mighty good.
Yes.
I could do a lot of stuff with that. I could have, I could even do good. Well, I could give half of it to charity. I could give half of it to Living Compassion.
Yes.
And just only take the other half for myself. And what difference does it make? And, you know, they're a bunch of crooks anyway. You know, they cheat people all the time. And I work so hard, but I look over that opposite wall and I see that no more self-hatred. And I realize, no, I don't want to do that. Because the net result of that is going to be self-hatred, and I don't want it.
Yes. Hmm? Yes.
So making that, learning to distinguish between, to differentiate between pleasure and happiness, the happiness that comes from making decisions and choices from the heart, the pleasure that comes from getting the whatever it is that ego says is going to make a difference for me in the moment, as I begin to see the difference between those two, life just gets easier and easier.
Yes, yes. What you were talking about pleasure made me think of grasping and not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have this pleasure now, but it wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Yes.
It's not as
and I need,
pleasurable.
Yes, well, I need more.
I need more.
Yeah, I need that, and that's going to give me the, yes, that's really important. It has that grasping quality to it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. And so there's nothing to say that a person shouldn't enjoy pleasure.
Yes.
You know, a happy life is endlessly pleasurable.
Yes.
That's very different from, actually, either one of them, it's not possible to go at directly. You know, you can't go at happiness directly.
Yes.
If you do, you'll just get unhappiness. You can't go at pleasure directly. They're both byproducts.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that the only way to know that is to have the experience.
Yes. And, you know, with this stuff, it's you know, I don't make this up. you know, if a person does the experiments, has the experience, I think these are the conclusions that they will get to.
Yes.
So there's nothing to believe about it. There's nothing to feel good or bad about. You know, it's not about being the right person or wrong person. You know, you put gas in your car, it'll run longer. It has nothing to do with being a good person or a bad person.
Yes.
You put gas in your car, doesn't make you a bad person. It just makes you a person who's sitting by the side of the road because you didn't put gas in your car.
Yes.
And if we can sort those things out, because you know, in our conditioned world, those are the same thing. You don't put gas in your car. You are a fool, and you deserve every bad thing that happens to you.
Uh-huh.
But no, no.
Right.
No, you just didn't put gas in the car, so you ran out, and this is what happens to a car when it runs out of gas.
Yes.
That's all. It doesn't mean anything.
Yes.
And so then we start making different choices. Now, do I want to sit by the side of the road, or do I want to tootle along in the direction that I was heading? I'd like to tootle along. Okay, I think I'll stop and put gas in.
Yes, yes. That's a great example. Sherry, we have about 4 minutes left here and a couple of email questions. I think we have time for one more.
All right.
Dear Sherry, a few months ago, I was suffering from a health problem and began meditating at the suggestion of a stress reduction program. For the first 2 to 3 months of my new meditation practice, I couldn't wait to get home to sit. I was feeling so much more centered and compassionate as a result of sitting, like my eyes were seeing the world through a new lens. Each day, I would discover something new in the process that made me love it even more. However, for the past few weeks, I have been struggling with my practice. I feel like each meditation is 45 minutes of me just trying to get through it. My brain wanders off on so many tangents that it seems that all I am doing is trying to come back to a centered place before I wander off again. If I happen to notice one or two breaths in between, it is rare. I am starting to feel resentful of sitting, like it is something I have to do, not something I want to do. I don't want to quit because I feel like it has changed the way I participate in my life in such a positive way, but I'm feeling really discouraged and frustrated. I have read several of your books and been to your talks and weekend seminars when they come through Colorado. Can you offer me any insight on what I'm going through and how to work through this?
Yes.
Sincerely, from a listener in Boulder, Colorado.
I love Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah.
It's such a great place, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, but meditation can become tedious even there. So here's the deal. First of all, don't sit for 45 minutes. Too long.
Yes.
Too long. I know people disagree with me on that, but I don't care. If you want to sit for longer, then sit for half an hour and get up and do a period of walking meditation and then go back and sit down again.
Yes.
The thing that the person is describing, of course, is meditation. So it's kind of, you know, I'm sorry, this is just so cliche, but I have to do it. You know, I fall in love and everything is great, and then one day I realize I'm in a relationship. And not only am I in a relationship, but it's with a regular human being who has annoying habits and says irritating things. And, gee, well, that's just how it is. You know, if you want to be in a relationship with a human being, that's what human beings are like. And if you want to meditate, that's what meditation is. Now, meditation, of course, in and of itself, is not like that. But what the writer is running into is conditioning, saying enough of this love affair that you're having with meditation.
Yeah.
I am not getting enough of your time and attention for myself, and I am the star of your life, so knock it off and pay attention to me. And that's what's happening in the practice. So it's 45 minutes of sitting there watching how, only not watching, sitting there experiencing what it's like when egocentricity is thwarted.
Yes.
To me, that's a big reason we meditate, is to see how it all works.
Yes.
We're not meditating because it's a high. We're not meditating because it's going to make us feel good all the time. What we're learning to do is pay attention and see how suffering is caused. And the writer is getting a big, up-close, and personal view of how suffering is caused. Egocentric karmic conditioning says, I don't like this, no, I don't want this, stop, and then it proceeds to make everything miserable until the poor little human does whatever in an attempt to get it to stop torturing. But the thing is, every time we go through one of those little dances, what happens is that egocentric karmic conditioning is reaffirmed. It gets one more piece of information that says, if I squawk loud enough, if I make things miserable enough, I'll get my way. And awareness practice, as we were talking about earlier, is a process of saying no to egocentric karmic conditioning. Anybody who's ever had a two-year-old around knows that saying no to egocentricity is not a pleasant way to spend a day. But just as two-year-olds one day become three, egocentric karmic conditioning one day will lose its power to torture in that way. And so I would encourage the person, get a timer that's set for half an hour, sit down, and then after the meditation period even, not during, after, get up and make some notes about what was seen, about what the voices were saying and what the threats were and the discomfort and what this means and the here and there and all over the map. Start writing it down and start seeing it as a process rather than this is just how it is and there's really something wrong with me and I need another pastime.
Yes, yes. And as you're describing that, I'm reminded of the letter you sent out yesterday describing how to do process mapping, which is really great.
Yeah, good. Did I get all the points?
Yes.
Pretty good, huh?
Yes,
good.
Fabulous.
It's a lot to try to describe. I didn't really realize it until I started writing it down, that it's, you know, there are a lot of steps, but I think that would certainly get anybody started. And then when they get, you know, that part down, they can call into the radio show and we'll all have a conversation about where to go next.
Yes.
So maybe the writer will hear this show, and if he or she is not on the mailing list, can contact Living Compassion and say, you know, send me that email on process mapping.
Yes.
And it'll come out, and that's a good tip.
Wonderful. Sherry, this has been a lot of fun.
It has been a lot of fun, and we got through almost all of them.
Almost all the questions.
Yeah, so people have to send in a lot more questions, and because possibly while I'm in Africa, we might want to do this same sort of thing again. I don't know, you might have a different plan for us.
Yeah.
But it's always good to have those questions.
Yes. Thank you so much,
Michael.
Sherry.